Welcome to another episode of Living Downstream. In this episode, we'll hear from Peggy Cheatham of Umpqua Wildlife Rescue and Megan Graham of Saving Grace. Both will talk about how to care for different types of animals, whether wildlife or domesticated pets such as cats and dogs. My name is Ryan, and I am the host of Living Downstream. I'm an AmeriCorps member serving in the role of Environmental Education and Outreach Leader for the organization Umpqua Watersheds. Before we begin, I'd like to do a land acknowledgement. I think it's important to remember that the land upon which Umpqua Watershed is located was formerly occupied by various indigenous groups, including Cow Creek Umpqua, Coquille, and Malala, among others. I'm here with Peggy Cheatham, president of Umpqua Wildlife Rescue, who's going to share a few things about wildlife rehab. To start things off, what is wildlife rehabilitation?
Wildlife rehabilitation is a vocation, a hobby, a career that some choose that deal with the sort of being first responders, so to speak, to the injured adult wildlife and orphan baby wildlife that are native to the state that you happen to live in and trying to give them a second chance.
What does Umpqua Wildlife Rescue do and why is it so necessary in this region?
Umpqua Wildlife Rescue is sort of unique in that we aren't a true wildlife center. It was designed by two wildlife biologists, Marnie Albritton and Nancy Duncan, back in 1987. And it was intentional. Their goal was to create a more intimate setting, a more one-on-one type of care. So Umpqua Wildlife Rescue was created sort of as it's a nonprofit organization, all volunteer organization, that is sort of what I like to say is the umbrella that individual licensed wildlife rehabilitators in Douglas County stand under. And what Umpqua Wildlife Rescue does is recruit, train, and mentor, help individuals get licensed, and help individuals get rehab facilities set up on their properties so that they can do rehabilitation from their home. We also have officers, we have board members, we have monthly meetings, we have workshops, we network together and offer that support and assistance.
That's awesome. It makes a lot of sense to have, you know, multiple people working together on it since, you know, rescuing injured and orphaned wildlife is way too big of a task for anybody to handle on their own. Which species does your organization accept? Are there any species that you can't take in?
Yes. We accept most of the common animals. We're not, by state law, allowed to, in the state of Oregon, to do what are considered non-native species in Oregon, which would be, in the bird world, it would be starlings and house sparrows, and in the mammal world, it would be possums and nutria, primarily. I think those are our most common non-natives that we're not allowed to rehabilitate. As far as everything else, there are restrictions on certain animals that Department of Fish and Wildlife don't allow rehabilitation of, like wolves and coyotes. Other than that, we're pretty much cougar. We can't do cougar or bear. We can receive bear cubs and get them transported, turned into the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and they transport them up to other facilities out of state that actually have proper setups to do bear cubs.
Yeah, I bet bears need a little bit bigger and more durable enclosures. I read your longitudinal study about rehabilitated deer fawns. I was wondering if you could share your findings and their significance with the audience.
Well, the whole significance of fawn rehabilitation is sort of a controversial issue. When I came on the scene in 1996, there was not a fawn rehabilitator in Douglas County. There had been in our organization in the past by a couple ladies that did it prior to me that were invaluable to me for mentoring and training. When I decided that that's what I wanted to do, because my whole goal was to sort of fill a gap that wasn't being filled. And I asked during the class that I was taking at UCC, where are the gaps? And one of the instructors mentioned that there's no fawn rehabilitation right now, and it might be a difficult situation to be allowed to do it. Anyway, I set out to do it, and I was finally given permission by the wildlife biologists and sort of the matriarchs of our organization that said, if you're going to do it, we'll support you, we'll help you, we'll fund you, but we're going to develop a program that not only works, but works well, so that we can prove that fawn rehabilitation can be successful and that it can be done in a quality fashion, because the myth out there amongst wildlife biologists are that fawns cannot be rehabilitated properly and be released and be integrated in wild herds and reproduce. They're a prey species, they tame up easily, it's dangerous to humans, and they don't behave like deer. So that was my whole sort of my whole mission. And with the help and care of Marnie Albritton, Nancy Duncan, and Rhiannon LaFarique, who did fawns prior to me, I kind of stood under their umbrella and was mentored, and we created this program. The other thing is that Marnie insisted that I keep data and keep ear tag them, monitor them, journalize them, and do this study that ended up in the IWRC, the International Wildlife Rehab Council's Journal of Scientific Data. And I honestly probably would have never gone to that degree without her nudge, her gentle nudge. However, I am so happy that she did, and she worked with me hand in hand, because it is important information, and it does dispel the myth and prove that with proper methods, they can be given a second chance. They can be cared for. We're not allowed to take in adult deer, so it's all about the newborn fawns or fawns up to a certain age that really are just getting started in life, and generally the parents or the mother has been hit and killed, or it's been displaced from mom, and we can't find where it goes back. And often a good majority of them are healthy little fawns. They just need proper, husbandry and care, so that they can go out and do what they were meant to do. And so that's the whole study of what we were able to prove.
It's great that you were able to collect data to show that success.
Yeah, I don't really think it's ever been done for that length of time, for 15 years on fawns, simply because most fawn rehab programs weren't done in a quality fashion, and they weren't able to be released on site. So they were taken way out in the woods, way up, so they wouldn't encounter people, which doesn't serve the fawns well. They don't survive well that way either, but they're not able to be really monitored very well. So I was privileged to be able to ear tag them and watch them on my mountain and watch them reproduce and bring their children down into the valley. And, it was very, very rewarding experience.
Is there anyone rehabilitating fawns now?
Yes. So in our county, Todd Lum, who's our district biologist that governs us, it allows us to do fawn rehab, but really only one person at a time, because fawns being a herd animal, they need to all come together. They need to be raised together, and if at all possible, released together. And so if someone wants to step down, as long as there's someone in place and that person's willing to mentor that person, and the organization is keeps an eye on it, make sure that it's done in the way we've developed, then they're allowed to. So Lynn Young, who's been in our group for quite a few years, is our current fawn rehabilitator, and she's down out in the backwoods of Myrtle Creek. She's been doing them since I stepped out about, I think, 7 years ago or so, 7 or 8 years ago.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense to raise them and release them together since they're a herd animal. Probably increases their success rate. What are some important things that our listeners should keep in mind if they find wildlife that they think might be hurt or abandoned?
Well, the first thing to remember is the safety of yourself or your children. Wild animals aren't always kind and friendly. They can bite, they can scratch, they can hurt you. They carry disease, they can pass disease. And so that's the first most important thing, is to not get your hands on them if at all possible. If you think an animal is in danger or it's an orphan baby, just note the location, call Umpqua Wildlife Rescue, and if you don't have our number, you can call the Department of Fish and Wildlife, the state police. They all have our number. They all know we work together, and they will see that we get involved, and then we can better assess the situation. A lot of little baby animals are mistakenly taken by well-intended public who think they're, where's mom? Where's the parent? And a lot of the parents leave their young on purpose. They have to go forage, they have to go find food, they have to bring food back. They've tucked this baby in, they're hoping that it's safe, and it's a matter of just leaving it alone. But we're pretty good at assessing whether we feel like it's in danger, or if it's been abandoned, or if maybe there's no parent around any longer. So don't touch them, leave them there.
Yeah, I've heard of lots of times where people are thinking an animal's been abandoned, but their parents know best, and taking them away can actually hinder their chances of survival.
Well, and the sad part, well, back to fawns. Fawns are often mistakenly taken because the fawn for the first few weeks of life doesn't have a scent, but the mother does. So mom tucks it down on purpose. It lays very flat, very still. She leaves for the day. She may only come at dusk and dawn to feed it, and then she'll move it again. And people stumble upon them, and it won't stand on purpose. They want to lay flat and they think something's wrong, and then they take it home and they forget exactly where it came from. And so then it's not possible to put it back, which is sad because the mom's going to be out there looking for it, And so you want to just leave it. And everybody has cell phones now. Step away, call on the phone while you're there, if you want to keep an eye on it and make sure that that it truly is orphaned or injured, and let the trained volunteers be the ones to handle it so that you don't get injured.
Yeah, I've also done some research and attended like workshops and conferences and things on rabies vector species. That's difficult too, because people are thinking, oh, this animal seems hurt, and then they take it in. But then if they or their kids or even their pets come into contact with that animal, whether the animal actually has rabies or not, that animal often has to be euthanized to determine whether it does in fact have rabies.
Right,
Really?
and the only way you can test rabies is to unfortunately euthanize the animal and test the brain, and so it loses its life, maybe unnecessarily,
Well, jumping off of that, what are the biggest challenges of wildlife rehabilitation?
Well, I would just speak from our region and our county. Umpqua Wildlife Rescue is a body of all volunteers. We have a president, vice president, secretary, treasurer. We have board members. We have rehabbers and subcommittees, and we have volunteers who choose not to be rehabilitators, but to help with our hotline and our newsletter and critter carrying and rescuing. One of the challenges in our county is if it's a passion of yours and if it's something you want to do for a career, Douglas County isn't the place that's going to happen. Also, even careers in wildlife rehabilitation where there are true centers, that they don't pay the very best. And it does require a lot of training and a lot of medical, animal training. It's kind of sad to see that there isn't a slot for it that would make it a little bit more valuable. But in our county, being all volunteer, the biggest challenge is finding time for it. And if it's not your career and you have a full-time job to help support your family and you want to fit this in, it can be very, very tricky. And it just simply doesn't work for everybody. If you work full-time and you have kids and you have just weekends, it's probably not going to work out for you. A lot of the members have always been, they have unique situations. They're either self-employed where they can carve out the time, they're stay-at-home parents, they are older and retired and are looking for something to do. So it can be very tricky. I mean, when you're talking baby season, which starts in like March and runs through the summer, baby birds have to be fed every 30 minutes, you know, and they pretty much go where you go. If you can't take them to work and you shouldn't, it's not going to work. And so I was fortunate when I started, my husband and I had a business on our property and I had a big shop and I just went down to my shop and worked. And then I'd take a break and go up and feed fawns and then I'd come back. So, you know, you can be creative that way if you have the ability to and the, you know, opportunity, but it's a difficult thing to fit into already busy lives.
Yeah, animals definitely need a lot of care, especially if they're injured or infants. And wild animals, like, you know, not d domesticated pets or something, require additional time and knowledge, like you said. So I'm wondering, what are the other ways, or are there some other ways how people could help if they can't commit to being a rehabilitator, but they do want to assist with your efforts? You know, do you have a wish list of needed items that people could contribute?
We do accept donations. In fact, we're completely supported by donations locally and globally. One of the great things is with the social media now that as prolific as it is, we've been able to have a Facebook page and a website. A lot of people view us and we get mostly our donations through there or they find out about us and will send us a donation. So it's actually what keeps us going. And you can go to our website, Umpqua Wildlife Rescue, and our Facebook page and check us out. I think maybe on the Facebook page and or website there I think was a wish list. If you, I would just say if you have items that you're wanting to donate, any kind of care, towels, paper towels, old baby socks. We use baby socks to put over raptors' heads when we're x-raying them. Any of those type things, you could just connect with us through the Facebook page or the website.
Great. Yeah, I know sometimes we, you know, have extra things lying around and we don't really need them, but maybe somebody else does need them or could use them. And yeah, I hadn't heard of the baby socks thing. So if anybody out there is sitting on a bunch of baby socks, Umpqua Wildlife Rescue could use them.
Let us know. I was trying to think of other little things, but yeah, sanitation wipes, you know, they're big these days, and sanitation products. Most of our medical supplies we get some of them donated from Mercy via a veterinarian who gets a lot of products from Mercy who shares with us, and we purchase quite a few things. One of the bigger things too we've been talking about lately is getting donated meats from people. If you have like leftover venison that you're going to ditch from last year because you got new, we're always in need of things like venison and fish, rabbit, quail, rats and mice if they're not poisoned, if they're snap trapped. You know, so we use lots of that stuff.
Do you have any recommendations for anyone who might be listening and thinking they do want to become a wildlife rehabber?
I would say, you know, connect with our organization. We're the only organization by way of sending a message through the Facebook page or the website, and let us know that right now, unfortunately, during COVID, we're not able to meet in person, which is really hard when you have a setup like we do, where we're all rehabbing from our homes anyway. Our big moment together was always our monthly meetings, where we could share information and do the business we need to, but talk about what animals we have and so forth, and meet new people. And right now, we're doing all virtual meetings, so it's Zoom once a month. And if you want to be a part of that, and kind of get to know us and let us get to know you, you can certainly get that information from our website and Facebook page. As far as classes right now, we're on hold on that too to do new training. So, but it's a step to get involved and let us know who you are. We could probably get you involved in certain things, you know, until we can hold classes and train.
Is there anything else you'd like to share before we wrap up the interview?
You know, if wildlife rehabilitation is your passion, it's a great starting point, even if it's not somewhere you're going to stay. If you're, you know, you can get some good credentials that'll help you along in your life and your career if you want to work with wildlife. And we always need really good, solid, sound volunteers that can help in all facets. You know, like if you do work, it doesn't mean you can't be involved with us. That means that maybe you could take a hotline day on your day off, or you could help with the newsletter or help with fundraising, and then every now and then maybe come and help a rehabber at their facility, feed and clean cages and things like that.
Well, thank you for all the information. It was great to have you on the show. I'm pleased to announce that we'll now hear a song from Marnie Alberton, who helped Uncle Wildlife Rescue get its start. Thanks, Marnie.
This is for an eagle that I helped rehab up in Washington State. It's called Golden Friend.
That was wonderful, Marnie, and really relates to our topic this week. Thank you so much for sending that in. If there's anyone else who has environmentally related music that they would like to have included on the show, please email ryan@umpquawatersheds.org. Again, that's ryan@umpquawatersheds.org, and we'll check it out and see if it's a good fit. here with Megan Graham, Executive Director of Saving Grace Pet Adoption Center in Roseburg. For anyone unfamiliar with Saving Grace, can you start off by sharing a little about your organization?
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for having me today, Ryan. I appreciate it. So Saving Grace has been around for about 20 years, and we are located in Roseburg, Oregon. We serve all of Douglas County for animal sheltering services. We hold the contract with Douglas County to take in any and all stray dogs, and we also accept cats and small animals here. We just recently started providing a limited amount of public spay and neuter as well for people who are lower income. And we just started a pet food bank where we offer free pet food for people in need on a bi-monthly basis out at Stewart Park. So those are kind of our main programs, you know, animal sheltering, reuniting lost pets with their families, the pet food bank, and spay and neuter. And we hope to kind of expand on those programs in the coming years.
That's great. Thank you. How did you get started in animal welfare or shelter and rescue work?
Well, I have been doing animal welfare work for about 12 or 13 years now. And it all started when I was working a really boring office job. And I felt like I needed to give back to the community in a different way. And I have always loved animals. So I started volunteering at our local spay and neuter clinic over in Bend. And that spun wildly out of control. And I ended up joining the staff and then joining the board of directors. I moved to Austin, Texas for a moment and kind of got a crash course in everything high volume, high quality spay and neuter, which was wonderful and prepared me to come back to Bend and become the executive director of the spay and neuter clinic there, which I did for about 7 years prior to coming here and starting here at Saving Grace. And in the meantime, I picked up some other experience working for international spay and neuter organization, as well as a statewide organization called Fences for Fido.
Yeah, sounds like you've done a lot of stuff relating to animal welfare, so that's great.
That was the short version, so.
How many animals did you end up with? Did you adopt any of the pets?
Right. So thankfully I've had a significant other in my life for the majority of this time that's kept me under control in terms of how many animals I bring home. So right now we have 2 rescued pit bulls and 3 cats, all of them, you know, rescued or broken or foster failures or whatever. But yeah, we're trying to not bring any more into the house at this point, but it is tough.
Yeah, that was my rule. I volunteered at various animal shelters ever since I was in, you know, middle school or high school. And my one rule my mom had is that you're not bringing any of them home. So yeah. It's very challenging sometimes.
Yes, it definitely is. Like the foster thing, it works most of the time, but it's sometimes you fail. So
yeah. But in this case, failure is also a good thing because they're getting a home, right?
That's true. It's not really a failure. So yeah, you're right.
Why does pet overpopulation exist and why is it a problem?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question. Because, you know, working here at the shelter is different. My background, as I mentioned, is working in high volume spay neuter, and that is the preventative aspect of animal welfare. And now I'm working on the flip side of that, which has been a little bit of a change for me. You know, pet overpopulation exists, in my opinion, just having the experience that I've had working all around the world and seeing free roaming animals in various environments, from Hawaii to, you know, the Galapagos and everywhere in between. You know, it's primarily because of a lack of resources. There's a lack of affordable resources for pet owners and people who want to do the right thing and take care of their pets, but, you know, they are not able to afford it. So, you know, high volume spay neuter, free, affordable, high volume spay neuter that takes away the barriers that people face to caring for their pets is really, in my opinion, the answer to at least addressing the problem of pet overpopulation or starting to address it. And then I think, you know, as a society, we've started to really consider pets to be more like family in recent years. And that whole mindset, I think, will ultimately help to combat pet overpopulation as well as time goes on. The more we think of our pets as family, the less we want to put them in danger, or the less we, you know, feel comfortable letting them be outside, letting them free roam on their own, and not providing basic veterinary care such as spay, neuter, and vaccinations.
Yeah, I feel like our perception on anyone or anything really impacts you know, how we act, whether it's about the environment, you know, in general, or specifically with animals, dogs and cats and things.
Yeah, definitely. And just having the opportunity to provide these services for your pet is huge. And a lot of people, let's face it, you know, just don't have access to care. And that's really the biggest problem. But thankfully, we are starting to address that in animal welfare, and we're starting to create affordable options for veterinary care for people who wouldn't normally be able to afford it. So it's going in the right direction.
Awesome. You mentioned free roaming animals. And I know there's some controversy over whether or not to let pets, you know, roam free outdoors. Can you explain some of the reasons for and against free roaming cats and dogs?
Sure. I mean, honestly, there's not a whole lot of reasons for, if you have the luxury of keeping your pet indoors. So it comes again, kind of back to resources. You know, if you live on an island and your home is a tent, or your home is, you know, something that's barely sufficient for humans, you know, can we expect that you're going to be able to contain your pet? You know, maybe not. But then when we look at, you know, situations even here in the United States, having worked for Fences for Fido, this organization that provides enclosures for dogs so that they are not able to free roam, you know, I think that people oftentimes have good intentions and don't necessarily want their pets to be free roaming, but that's just what happens because of the circumstances that they're in. You know, that being said, I think there's many, many more arguments to be made for pets not to be free roaming. But again, sometimes it's just the circumstances that people find themselves in and they don't really have any other choice. But nowadays we've got Fences for Fido, we've got Catios for cats, we've got some options, but again, not necessarily always for people who don't have the resources. So yeah, I'm not sure, that kind of just touches on an answer to your question, but we could go a lot deeper into that probably.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking, you know, like I've heard people say, oh, we should have dogs and cats be able to be outside more because, you know, they're coming, your descendants from wild animals, they deserve to be outside. But then I've also, yeah, kind of on the side of not letting animals free roam. Like I know one argument has been, you know, cats when they're out will attack birds and other wildlife. So that's, I know that's one like kind of serious concern, but then some people have barn cats to keep the, you know, rodent population down. So it's kind of like, yeah, cats are probably going to kill something. It's may or not kill what you want them to kill.
Yeah, it's tough because, like, ideally, you know, you wouldn't have outdoor cats. But again, because it kind of, again, comes back to not having access to spay and neuter, people have put their cats outside unspayed and neutered. And that's kind of the situation that we're in now. So, you know, at this point, I think managed outdoor colonies, meaning, you know, colonies that have all been spayed and neutered and vaccinated and will eventually decrease over time, is the answer, but that's a very, it's very resource heavy and it's difficult. And it takes someone who really, really cares about those colonies to manage them, and to make sure that they all get fixed and to find a place that will fix them all for free or very inexpensive. So in an ideal world, we're addressing those outdoor cat situations by managing colonies, and eventually they're going to go away. But, you know, in the real world, that's not necessarily always the case, especially here in Douglas County. We've got many, many, many outdoor cats who probably do have an impact on the bird population here, unfortunately. But what has been proven to work in terms of managing their population is spay and neuter and not just simply removing them and killing them. That has been proven to not work. And obviously it's also not a humane alternative. So we don't support that personally here, but we do recognize that there is an issue. And in terms of dogs, obviously we don't want free roaming dogs because they're an potential safety hazard, you know, for cars. They're gonna potentially injure themselves. We wanna do whatever we can to prevent dogs from being free roaming, and that includes neutering them, which again comes back to the whole spay and neuter thing. Dogs are much less likely to roam if they've been neutered. So
yeah, it sounds like spaying and neutering is the answer to a lot of the problems.
If you ask me, it is.
Yeah, I kind of think so too, because yeah, I just feel like, you know, humans kind of made the problem, right? This is definitely an issue that humans over generations have led to, you know, being a problem in the first place. You know, we domesticated animals, we started to have them as pets, which is, yeah, you know, I love that, you know, kids, adults, families, my family has always has lots of pets. And it's a great experience, but also we have to be as responsible as we can be about that, you know, not letting them just
proliferate continually, and then that can cause lots of problems, and then they're getting hit by cars, and yeah, so it's not good for anybody.
Yeah, they rely on us, you know, to be their caretakers to some degree, and we have to make sure that we set them up for success as best we can, and that, you know, that includes as the shelter that we're setting up our community members for success in terms of offering affordable services to help them keep their pets safe, to help them keep their pets in their homes. And that's kind of brings me to a little bit of where we're kind of, the shelter's kind of going in that direction. We're hoping to be able to offer more services that are more proactive and will keep pets in their homes, as opposed to being the place where you take your pet if you can't keep them. We want to be the people who are going to help you figure out how to keep your pet in your home, as opposed to, you know, where you would bring your pet if you don't have any other choice.
That's great. Yeah, it's nice to hear that you're expanding programs, because, you know, everybody knows life happens and things get tough sometimes. But yeah, if there's a resource or some support to assist people, like you mentioned about the, you know, the food bank. Everybody's kind of feeling the struggle right now with COVID, and just, you know, people are out of work and things. And so it makes sense that if people don't have really enough money for their own food, oh man, like I also have all these pets. So yeah, that's just a great service that you're providing, and sounds like you're going to provide more as well.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. I mean, sometimes it is just as simple as helping someone get through a couple months by providing them with some extra dog food. And you know, you just, if you don't ask, you don't know. So sometimes people will just bring their animal and try to surrender them, and that they're really upset about it. And you just have to ask a few questions, and then they're very shocked to learn that we can actually help them keep their pet in their home. So that's always cool when that happens.
Yeah. I know we're about to head into kitten and puppy season, the time in spring when there's kind of an influx of litters to shelters and rescue groups. What can our listeners do to help?
I guess first and foremost, I would plead with our community to leave neonatal baby kittens alone. Do not bring us tiny kittens. Those kittens are, even if they're alone, mom is probably out hunting. She will be back. You know, if they have been alone for more than 24 hours, obviously contact us. Just call us first, though, and let us help you assess the situation before you move them, before you bring them to us. Because once those tiny kittens come into the shelter, you know, we've got to figure out how to keep them alive. And oftentimes it's pretty difficult without mom. So we hate to have that happen. And we would like to, you know, at least give them a fighting chance. So if you find baby kittens, do not kidnap them. Just leave them where they are would be the biggest help. And then obviously signing up, I think you mentioned fostering, signing up to foster for us is always super helpful. We do get inundated with kittens around March and spring, and then usually again in the fall. But the more foster families we have, the more likely we're going to be able to get those cats into homes once they're old enough.
Yeah, I recently signed up to foster, and I'm very excited about it. So yay, anything we can do to help.
Thank you, Ryan. That's awesome.
Yeah, so anybody else out there who's listening and thinking, oh, I might like to see a litter of kittens, you know, and help them, but I don't necessarily want to keep them all. That's a prime opportunity.
It's super fun. I mean, they are adorable, and they're really fun to have around your house. And it's a temporary commitment, like you said. So it's, and then we provide all the stuff that you need, if you need food and even a container cage. You know, we have a big like pop-up crate that you can borrow to keep them in, and we give you all the instructions and all that. So yeah, if you're interested, you can sign up on our website, savinggracepetadoptioncenter.org. You can sign up to be a foster there. So
great. Yeah, I'll share that resource. We have a resource section on the website, so I'll share that in our resource section.
Thank you.
What are some other ways people can support the animals at Saving Grace in addition to fostering? You know, also, are there certain items that, you know, Saving Grace could use, donations of, you know, materials?
Yeah, I mean, as you can imagine, we go through a ton of laundry detergent. So we always need liquid laundry detergent. We always need bleach. Ziploc bags we need for our pet food bank. We do take donations of pet food. Right now we have quite a bit. So in the future, we take donations of pet food. We don't want to sit on it too long here. So we actually have quite a bit, like I said, right now. But we also are always in need of volunteers here at the shelter to help us walk dogs, to help hang out with our cats. Pretty much anything that you're interested in doing, we can find something for you to help with. So
that's great. Do you have any other ideas or suggestions for our audience?
Well, I guess just if you haven't already signed up for our newsletter, you can do that on our website too and keep up to date with all the stuff that we've got going on. And feel free to stop by and visit us anytime or give us a call to learn more about our organization and check out our new website. Actually, is still in progress, but it's pretty well up and running at this point. So again, SavingGracePetAdoptionCenter.org.
In today's episode, we heard from Umpqua Wildlife Rescue's Peggy Cheatham and Saving Grace Pet Adoption Center's Megan Graham about what their organizations are doing to help local wildlife and domesticated animals, and opportunities for you to support their efforts. We learned about the important and difficult job of wildlife rehabilitators, what to do if you find injured or potentially orphaned animals. In case you forgot, don't automatically pick them up or remove them from the location, because mom might be nearby. When in doubt, contact Umpqua Wildlife Rescue if you find young wildlife, or Saving Grace if you stumble upon a litter of kittens or puppies. We also heard what we can do with last year's venison, where to take donations of laundry detergent, reasons not to let pets roam free outdoors, especially if they're not spayed or neutered, and creative uses for baby socks. If you'd like to get involved with either organization in a more active way, check out their websites, which will be posted in our resource section. If your work schedule and housing situation allow for it, I know both organizations would be grateful for the extra support, especially as we head into spring, one of the busiest seasons because of the influx of various types of litters. Living Downstream has now officially been on air for an entire month. Woohoo! So far on the show, we've had episodes about on-trail hiking, the role of art in environmentalism, water quality, observing birds and other wildlife, wildfires in the Pacific Northwest, and now caring for critters. We've had interviews with hikers, artists, naturalists, scientists, educators, and animal advocates. I'm humbled to have been able to get to know and learn from such an amazing group of individuals from such varied backgrounds, who were so generous in sharing their knowledge and experience with me and all of Living Downstream's listeners. In celebration of the show's one-month anniversary, I've put together some highlights from the first 5 episodes. In episode 1, Diana Pace shared a number of local hikes, including ones accessible for children and people with limited mobility.
Another trail, which is not too long, it's only 1 mile round trip, it's got to drive up, you know, dirt roads to get there, and it's in the Rogue Umpqua Divide Wilderness, so you actually go there from Union Creek, but it's called Rabbit Ears, and they're like extinct volcano plugs that happen to be, you know, the way they stick up together, yeah. They look like rabbits. That would be a fun place to take kids, because it's not a long, hard hike.
Diana also gave recommendations for preparing for a hike.
You know, you want a good guide when you're out there. And then also, I like to call before I go to check on the status of that trail. They'll get information for you, you know, whether, hey, there's too many trees down, or that's closed due to the fire, or there's a bridge out, whatever, or no, hey, it's good to go. I prefer for people to be prepared and educated, you know, when they go out into the forest or the wilderness. 5 sections of the North Umpqua Trail were affected by this fire and are closed, and that's a big deal. Because usually when there's a fire up there, maybe one section will get affected and closed. But to have that much affected, I mean, that's how big the fire was.
I can certainly attest to the need for checking a site before hiking, both from the fires and now abundant rain, which has brought down some trees in various trails in the watershed. Connie Page described some of the lessons that she learned while hiking, including the reciprocal and compatible rather than competitive relationship of life in the forest.
I see trees that have been cut down, and the tree next to it will give it the nutrients it needs to maybe regrow. So you'll see the top that has been cut, but it's regrowing. Or you see the sister trees where one tree grows on top of another tree that's already been fallen. They support each other, and even when they're dead, they support so much wildlife, and then they give back to the soil. We have to stop looking at them like a commodity and start looking at them like a community, because that's what they are. My idea of hiking is to just totally immerse yourself in the, I don't go for speed, or I'm not trying to impress anyone. I just want the feeling of being out there with this tree community.
Additionally, Connie reflected on the wonder and awe she's experienced while spending time in nature.
I love hiking because you just find amazing. I love looking at the banana slugs when they come by, you know, when you run into one. The lizards around here are amazing.
In episode 2, we heard from local artists Elva Paulson and Susan Applegate, who shared how they got involved with nature art.
Well, I always attribute it to an experience I had in the third grade. You know, I attended the little country school out here, and this one teacher was very unusual. Let me say it like that, because she gave an assignment to us in the third grade that really opened my imagination. She said, illustrate the story that we've read. And no one had ever asked that of me. And my imagination went wild. And suddenly, all of the things that needed connecting in learning made sense. Once I could illustrate, draw what I was thinking.
They also shared recommendations for nature journaling.
Well, I would encourage anybody that has a little bit of a voice inside saying, you know, I think it would be fun to nature journal. My advice is to do it and to allow yourself to make a lot of mistakes. It's a working journal. I want to capture things in it. I don't want to worry about it being perfect.
They also described how art can encourage people to care for the environment.
I really ache for the fact that so many children are never up close and personal with nature. And I feel really fortunate that I grew up very close to nature. Whatever you love, you tend to protect. And so if I can open people's eyes, maybe they'll think a little bit differently next time they need to vote, or next time they need to make a donation, or next time they threaten to pull out certain plants or plant other plants, or, you know, hopefully it brings about some thought.
The visual arts is a form of storytelling. Each artist has a story that is particular to them that they wish to explore. The story that I find that I have been urged over and over to tell is what my experience has been here on this earth, in this place. I've had a very, very long conversation with this particular piece of land.
From there, we took a closer look at specific characteristics of the Umpqua watershed. In episode 3, we dove into water quality. Michael Jones gave some background on the way the landscape of this region contributes to the quality of our waters.
It's a good example of the different landscapes where the High Cascades is extremely young, completely changed by the eruption of Mount Mazama, where Crater Lake is today. And then there's this huge change around Tokadi to the Western Cascades, which is much, much older. The bedrock is so different. The river that runs by Roseburg is a combination of those two landscapes.
He also explained the impact of big storms on sediment load in the river.
When you get to the storms that are more than once every year or two, we call them a two-year flood or a bank full event, that's when you start to get enough power to move the sediment. Because once the stream goes over the banks, it doesn't have any more power. As it gets bigger, that power is distributed out, you know, over a much bigger area. So all the rocks and sand and gravel that are there sort of reflect that bank full flood event. So every time you get one of those, that's when the rocks start rolling. People that have been lucky enough to be out there at the time can hear them banging down the creek. And that's a rare event. Not so rare to happen, but pretty rare to be there and listen to it.
And the impact of human activity on water quality.
The difference between building a road right or making a housing subdivision with plenty of places for water to soak into the ground and that. The difference between doing it right and just with no thought to that, just building the road so all the road dumps into the creek or the subdivision has miles of bare ground, that can be a bigger difference than whether you have a road or a subdivision or not.
Sandy Lyon, Joe Carnes, and Emma Hansen joined us from Partnership for the Umpqua Rivers. They explained how their monitoring program got started, the contributions of PIRR in the community, and the role of volunteers in the organization.
PIRR's focus is primarily on whether the state of our waters are in good enough condition for survival and reproduction of healthy fish and aquatic creatures. Of course, we always wanted to know how safe our waters are for recreational and drinking water uses. With the various parameters that we monitor, we aim to gain a scientifically based understanding of current and changing watershed conditions. Our data provides PIRR project planning team and our partners information to support where restoration planning could be beneficial.
It would not be possible to collect all this valuable information without the support from the dedicated volunteers that they have.
PIRR strives to work with any willing landowner around the basin to develop a plan that will work for both the landowner and their specific needs, depending on their land use and their desires, in addition to what will be more beneficial for the environment. After a plan is reached, we work with them to implement anything from stream restoration to any best management practices they are willing to adopt.
We also heard some positive information based on the data collected from the loggers in local streams.
This year, we had temperature loggers deployed out in the Rock Creek area that burned in the Archie Creek fire. The data collected from these loggers showed us some interesting information. Although the fire burned severely through the area, primarily only little stream temperature spikes were observed. This is good news for the aquatic life. The conditions in the stream never demonstrated levels that would be harmful to in-stream life.
In the fourth episode, we learned how bioacoustic technology is being used to magnify the work being done by those monitoring birds in Oregon's forests. Damon Lesmeister explained how hundreds of hours of sound recordings are being processed.
We give it lots of different examples. So right now we're doing lots of work with spotted owls and marbled murrelets and barred owls. We give the machine lots of examples and we train it. Okay, this is what the call of a spotted owl. And it's actually what the call looks like because we have spectrograms and a visual representation of sound. And so it's really, I think it's revolutionized our ability for scale, especially the temporal scale.
Also in that episode, we heard Matt Hunter's recommendations for catching a glimpse of animals in the wild.
There's a really high correlation between how much time you spend out looking and what you end up seeing.
He also gave a few suggestions for how to attract desired wildlife species to your property.
Yeah, almost any change in habitat is a plus for some species and a negative for other species. So, you know, we tend to judge certain types of habitat changes, and that's understandable, but it really is usually just a change from one ecosystem to another. So
I hadn't thought about it that way, but he's right. It all comes down to what we value or what we want to see. Episode 5 was all about the history of wildfire and forest management practices in the Northwest. While technology enables us to get water quality readings during a forest fire and collect and process hundreds of hours of sound recordings so we can improve our understanding of birds in an area, dramatic changes to the impact we can have on a landscape are not always beneficial. Ken Carloni explained how we went from harvesting a few trees here and there to suddenly being able to decimate entire forests.
After, you know, World War II, middle of the last century, up until that point, trees were cut with enormous cross-cut saws with two guys on either side. You've probably seen the old photographs of the two loggers standing on springboards. It took them a couple, 3 days to cut down one of these big trees. So they would walk into a forest and they would pick the 10 trees in this particular acre or whatever that were suitable for logging, and they cut those down and they leave the rest. But with the advent of chainsaws and mechanization to haul these big trees out of the forest and so on, that was when the era of clear cutting came in, where they would just start on one side of a ridge and cut all the way down to the bottom of the creek and up the other side, and every single tree on the landscape would be cut.
And he explained why it's imperative that we don't cut all the trees down.
there's a sea of even age plantations with islands of old growth in them. That old growth, number one, they are treasure chests full of genetic diversity. And number two, they're treasure chests full of carbon, of stuff that we don't want to turn into greenhouse gases.
The problems we're facing in this time are pretty enormous, and many are human caused. But people can also be part of the solution. Spending time learning from all of the interviewees and appreciating the magnitude of their collective knowledge gives me hope that we can turn things around, that our children and grandchildren can walk in complex forests, swim in unpolluted waters, breathe clean air, observe diverse and interesting species outside alive, not just in textbooks. But it's going to require mindful changes. There are so many opportunities to get involved, to do something to improve the lives of those living downstream. Join me, and let's work for a greener future together.